This is COVID, Race, and Democracy. Stay tuned.
Welcome to Pacifica Radio's special broadcast, Black History in the Making, Reclaiming Our Past, Redefining Our Future. This show is presented by Pacifica Radio's COVID, Race, and Democracy and the Pacifica COVID Task Force. Stay with us.
Welcome to Pacifica Radio's special broadcast, Black History in the Making, Reclaiming Our Past, Redefining Our Future. I'm your host, Nikechi Taifa of WPFW in Washington, D.C. I'm an attorney, activist, and the author of the new memoir, Black Power, Black Lawyer, My Audacious Quest for Justice. This hour will feature a show chock full of info on reparations.
Who'll pay reparations on my soul? Many suggestions and documents written. For the aid that was given, they gave us pieces of silver and pieces of gold. Tell me who paid reparations on my soul.
Reparations, the subject is hot, scalding, and at one time unthinkable by mainstream society as viable public policy, yet it is only a question. Should the United States government, state governments, religious and academic institutions, corporations and industries, and yes, private estates pay reparations to the descendants of Africans held as slaves in the United States? Just a question, Congressman John Conyers would muse. We ask questions about everything, what's in space, what's underneath the water, interesting questions, he would say. But this one has been studiously avoided. The answer may be because few questions challenge society to consider over 400 years of history all at once, to tunnel within our souls and discover what we truly believe about race, equity, and the value to be placed on human suffering. Today's broadcast will feature clips from a multitude of advocates. The first half, we will hear from Joanne Watson and Maynard Henry about some of our reparations legends. We will hear from Adjoaye Toro and Julianne Malveaux, who will touch on injury areas suffered by Blacks during and after enslavement that must be addressed. We will hear from Erica Alexander and Jeff Robinson about upcoming documentaries on reparations and race. And we will hear about a 10-point reparations program from Ron Daniels. The second half of our broadcast will focus on local efforts for reparations from Evanston and Chicago, Illinois, with Robin Ruth Simmons and Cam Howard, and about advocacy in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and Elaine, Arkansas, with Demario Solomon Simmons and Iva Carruthers. And finally, we will hear about divisive threats to reparations efforts, as well as international standards from Jessica Ann Mitchell Ayuwior and Dreesen Heath.
Africans, the U.S. has never passed a reparations bill. Some folks say it's foolishness, and that it never will. The first reparations bill, it did not pass in 1896. Many more have come, still black folks find no fix.
The healing of the nation. The word is
reparations did not drop from the sky. The issue did not start with Ta-Nehisi Coates or with the 2020 candidates or the buzz that you hear today. Longtime advocates Joanne Watson and Maynard Henry will tell some stories from their personal experiences about some of our reparations legends who are now ancestors that helped to jumpstart this issue from the mid-20th century onward. Queen Joanne Watson, former Detroit City Councilwoman, pastor, host of Detroit's popular radio show, Wake Up Detroit, NAACP board member, staffer to Congressman John Conyers, longtime reparationist. Joanne Watson, how are you?
I'm wonderful, Queen Sister. My sister, Taifa.
You know, there are not a lot of people currently living who personally worked with or knew reparation icons such as Queen Mother Audley Moore, such as Brother President Dr. Imari Obadiali, or reparations Ray Jenkins, but you did, or at least to an extent you did. Tell us what you remember about them and their role in the reparations movement.
Well, certainly Queen Mother Audley Moore, Queen Mother Moore, we absolutely still love and respect her because the spirit never dies. So we honor her, we acknowledge her as the queen of our movement. And she's larger than life, legendary. And it was just, I had a chill whenever I was in her presence. The most amazing remembrance I have is when one of my INCOBRA conventions was in Detroit at the Cobo Center, and Queen Mother Rosa Parks was making her way down the center aisle to sit on the, we had directed her to sit right on the front row right next to Queen Mother Moore in that huge audience. And Dr. Mario Bedelli was at the microphone speaking. When he saw Mother Rosa Parks coming in, he had to stop and dab in his eyes because he said she called to prison when he was being held as a political prisoner regularly when she was working for Congressman John Conyers to talk to the prison staff and ask, was he okay? And she let them know it was Rosa Parks calling. And that made the whole room pause and give thunderous applause to Mother Parks, who was amazed by that kind of a response to her just walking down the center aisle. And for her, the two of them sitting together on that front row was absolutely awesome. I'll never forget it. Never forget it. Mother Parks was a revolutionary. People don't know that. Everybody knows Queen Mother Moore was, but so was Mother Rosa Parks. And I'm just so happy to know that. I was the person who gave reparations Ray Jenkins his name. He called my radio show Wake Up Detroit every day, always talking about reparations, which I love. And I knew what he was gonna say. So when I heard his voice, I said, oh, here comes the reparations message for today. And finally, I just started calling him Reparations Ray, and the name stuck. Reparations Ray Jenkins was just a tall, tall oak tree on reparations in this national movement. And he's the one that kept talking to Congressman John Conyers over and over and over again to introduce legislation for reparations, particularly after the Civil Rights Redress Act for Japanese Americans was introduced and passed by the United States Congress. He said, you can't let them get it and not let Black people be forgotten. It's a dead old. He would follow Conyers around to public meetings and stand up and make the demand. And Conyers finally said, you're right, Ray. And he did it. And H.R. 40 was introduced directly because of reparations Ray Jenkins, who treated me like a daughter. And in fact, I wrote his obituary. I loved reparations Ray Jenkins. He was just the magnificent man. He was a realtor by profession, but he spent all of his waking hours when he wasn't selling houses promoting reparations. Gaidi Obadiali and Imari Obadiali were very important parts of my life. They were guideposts. They were like father figures. They were directors. When I was working for Congressman John Conyers in his office, Imari Obadiali regularly called me in Conyers' office and give me directions of what to do. He was giving me work orders, and I'd have to remind him. I say, you know, we're talking on a government phone. He says, it's all right. They were magnificent freedom fighters, and they were the ones who taped Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s I Have a Dream speech in Detroit. They taped it with Berry Gordy equipment from Motown.
Wow. We're talking about iconic, iconic leaders, and you were right there in the midst of it. Reverend Joanne Watson, I mean, what more can I say? Attorney Maynard Henry, you have been active in both litigation and legislative initiatives and reparations. Your great uncle, Brother President Dr. Imari Obadeli, was my number one mentor in the struggle. Queen Mother Moore has been designated as the mother of the modern day reparations movement, but Dr. Imari Obadeli has been referred to as its father. But you know, most folk don't know anything at all about Brother Imari or of your role as counsel on lawsuits filed by him decades ago. Please share with us any words you may have about any remembrances you may have from the father of the U.S. reparations movement, your uncle, Imari Obadeli, that may have inspired you to do all of the great work that you're doing today.
Sure, Nkechi. Let me say this. I remember when he was called Richard B. Henry. That's how I knew him as a kid, as a young man up in Philadelphia. And then I would hear about this legend, Imari Obadeli. He changed his name to Imari Obadeli. I'm like, who is this Omari? Well, I knew him as a uncle, as a great uncle, the brother of my grandfather. And from that time as a young man to the present, I see that they were giants, even before I recognized what a giant really was. And one of the things that he allowed me to do was to grow as an individual, to grow as a person, and to grow, and not necessarily to be so focused on the movement per se, because he knew that was in the blood already. So he wanted to make sure that I got the necessary skills as a young person to have the wherewithal to be able to eventually come into the movement at full bloom at my own time. And as I got to start to work with him, in the late 80s, you know, one of his favorite quotes is that freedom ain't free. Just ask Dr. Imari Obadeli, that we're living in the belly of the beast and that land and power are the topics of the hour. And I think one of the things that we all have to understand now is that land is always going to be the topic of the hour. You look at the things that happen on Wall Street today, you know, the stock markets come and go, but land is the key. And he knew that. And so he always talked about the right to self-determination and his ability to be all African, to be pro-Black, to be pan-African. And so he inspired me to be able to take on lawsuits. And when he came knocking on my door, and said, hey, will you take up that first case for me, that Civil Liberties Act, that Japanese Civil Liberties Act, so that we can take that before the court. It went all the way from the United States Court of Claims to the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals, all the way up to cert to the United States Supreme Court. You know, Imari was the type of person that could speak to anyone and everyone, no matter who you are. He would speak to kings and queens. I remember the stories of him having the opportunity to be before people like Gaddafi. That was an interesting story in and of itself. And when you want to be pro-Black, he truly traveled on a passport from the Republic of New Africa, a driver's license, Republic of New Africa. The young so-called militants and revolutionaries of today don't understand that. If he didn't have to use the American dollar to spend money, he would not use it. But of course, you have to work within the system that you have. And so I step back and reflect. And one of the things that I want to say very quickly is the book that I have called Decolonization USA. It says, to my nephew with love and best wishes to you, Maynard and Sandy and children, Imari A. Obadeli. That book signing was back in 1996. And guess who the commentaries were? And Nkechi Tafai Esquire and Chokwe Lumumba. So he took you into those circles of giants. And so I stand on your heels too, Nkechi. And thank you.
Thank you so very much, Attorney Maynard. Hear me. That was phenomenal.
Let's see what one of us exiles in the person of Oscar Brown Jr. has to say about his condition.
While we're on that subject, I'd like to take this opportunity to present the following open letter that was pressed into my hands for special delivery by a man on my street. And yeah, he come now. If I'm not mistaken, I once read back during that short spell I spent in school, where every slave set free was supposed to get the fourth slave and 40 acres and a mule. Now, ain't no telling how much work was done by my ancestors under slavery's rule, but sure as hell the total got to run at least 40 acres and a mule. Now, I'm not saying this to see folks sweat, because I'm not bitter, neither am I cruel, but ain't nobody paid for slavery yet. About my 40 acres and my mule. We had a promise. That was taken back. And when we hollered, it was hush, be cool. Well, me, I'm being rowdy, hot, and black. I want my 40 acres and my mule.
In COBRA, the National Coalition of Blacks for Reparations in America, was founded in 1987 as the premier mass-based coalition organized for the sole purpose of obtaining reparations for African descendants in the United States. I was a 1987 founding member of NCOBRA, chair of its early legislative commission. We worked closely with Congressman John Conyers in formulating H.R. 40, which was introduced in 1989. H.R. 40 was named in remembrance of the 40 acres and a mule Blacks never received wholesale after enslavement, which is still due today in whatever form or forms are agreed upon. H.R. 40 will establish a commission to study and recommend proposals to Congress on appropriate remedies from the institution of slavery, its vestiges, and its impact on living African Americans today. Adjoa Ayotoro is professor emerita at the University of Arkansas at Little Rock, William H. Bowen School of Law, is a founding member of NCOBRA and its founding co-chair. Attorney Adjoa, when you were chair of NCOBRA's Legal Strategies Commission, the group developed 5 injury areas for reparations consideration. Can you, in just a nutshell, name these 5 areas and briefly describe them?
Okay, well, the 5 areas are criminal punishment, health, including mental health and physical health, wealth and poverty, education, peoplehood, nationhood. What we did was we chose the areas that we felt were the broad areas in which we were injured, harmed through the period of enslavement, as well as the vestiges of slavery. Collapsed within those are other things that people will talk about, like housing or whatever. But let's, criminal punishment, we all know. The disparity, the targeting of Black people. We know health, mental health, physical health. We're talking about it now with the coronavirus and how we're disproportionately impacted. Wealth and poverty. We continue to have a lower percentage of the wealth in this country and a higher percentage of the poverty. All of this due to how we have been excluded, punished, not given the worth. In fact, in slavery, we weren't even paid for our labor. We were free. We were forced free labor. Education. We all hear about how we were punished if we learned to read. Our schools continue to be disproportionately less adequate in terms of resources. And then finally, peoplehood and nationhood. Because what was taken from us, our own peoplehood, we were denied the right to speak our languages. And as we come up through all of these centuries since our enslavement, we see how we are continually denied, how we're continually tried to assimilate in our own culture denied.
Adjoa Ayotoro, thank you so very much.
You're listening to Black History in the Making, Reclaiming Our Past, Redefining Our Future. This show is presented by Pacifica Radio's COVID, Race, and Democracy and the Pacifica COVID Task Force.
One of NCOBRA's five injury areas is that of wealth and poverty. Dr. Julianne Malveaux is a noted labor economist, author, and president emeritus of Bennett College. As part of her testimony during the 2019 congressional reparations hearing, she noted that, quote, economics is the study of who gets what, when, where, and how. And she often speaks about the issue of economic terrorism and the fact that Black people have been discouraged from accumulating wealth.
Southern trees bear strange fruit. Blood on the leaves and blood at the root. Black bodies swinging in the southern breeze. Strange fruit hanging from the poplar tree.
Dr. Malveaux, can you briefly elaborate on these things?
Certainly. The first lynching that Ida B. Wells documented was a lynching of three of her friends who had opened a grocery store to compete with a white man's grocery store. Because they did that, long story, which we don't have time to get into, because they did that, they were lynched because they dared confront capitalism in their town, a store that exploited Black women, that was horrible. And because they opened a competing store, they were lynched. Of course, there was a pretext, but let's not talk about the pretext. Let's talk about the narrative that people say that lynching was about sex. It was about Black men raping white women. No. Ida B. Wells documented that, you know, at least a third of the lynchings were about economics, about putting fear into the hearts of Black people who dared to speak up, speak out. And so, and in the interest of sex, oftentimes those were consensual relationships with the white woman got scared and said rape. But back to the economic piece. The economic piece is that from the end of enslavement, the laws essentially conspired to keep Black people in an enslaved state. So if you didn't have a job, you could be arrested. And then you were put to work on one of the plantations that you had just finished working on. If you had a car, you could be lynched because how dare you uppity Black man have a car? If you, as a Black woman, there are several cases of Black women who stood up to the law and said, no, you cannot lynch my husband. And then they were lynched. They were hung. So literally, economic terrorism was about the consistent deterrence of Black people to accumulate wealth. So economics is the study of who gets what, where, and why, but it's also the study of who, how big is a pie and who holds the knife. And see, when Black people have never had the opportunity to hold the knife, what we've had to do is sit there and wait for the crumbs. And some folks have not waited for the crumbs, they've gone and grabbed them, and many paid with their life.
Now, more Reparations 2003 with Chuck Taylor.
If you're just joining us, Black people got their reparations checks today, and in short, all hell is broken loose. Fortune magazine released their annual list of the 100 wealthiest people today, and Bill Gates has been overtaken. By whom, you ask? A Harlem resident named simply Tron. Our Stephanie Gold is standing by with him now.
So how did you become the world's wealthiest man, Tron?
Hot hand in a dice game, baby girl. 6 hours straight, talking about clackety, 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 clack. Now you're looking at the world's richest man, and I'm Black.
Reparations have been made fun of, most notably Dave Chappelle's painfully hilarious episodes, which describe comically bad decisions Black folk would make if awarded reparations. Luckily, however, there are serious documentaries on the horizon about reparations. Erica Alexander, beloved for her iconic role as Max in Living Single, amongst many other acting roles past and present, is not only a brilliant actress, but a trailblazing activist, producer, and director. She is co-founder and chief creative officer of Color Farm Media, self-described as the Motown of film, TV, and tech. She's joining us today for just a quick chat. Erica, welcome, my sister.
Thank you, Nikichi. You are wonderful, and congratulations on all the work you do. Because of you, we can.
Thank you so very much, my sister. But you know, your documentary, John Lewis, Good Trouble, was a phenomenal, timely, and very important success. But I understand that you are currently co-directing a documentary film on reparations, which you began filming at that historic 2019 Juneteenth Congressional Reparations Hearing. My sister, tell us about this documentary in progress. Let us know what it's all about.
Well, I'm really happy and proud of the work on Good Trouble, and we're following it up with a great film about and on reparations. That's your name of the game. That's your side of the whole the whole rigmarole in America. And thank God for the work that you do. We have been, over the last 12 months, filming in Evanston, Illinois, where, as you know, Robin Rue Simmons passed the first reparations bill in history. We've also been in Washington, D.C. with H.R. 40, with Sheila Jackson Lee, as that moves forward. We've tied that into talking with experts like yourself and like all of your comrades who have been in this, you know, this has been a real big discussion, but trying to create the movement for all these years. So we co-direct, well, I should say I co-direct this film with Whitney Dow. We're both co-directing. He's a white man, so it's a multiracial, multigender team. We bring dual perspective, a very shared creative control to it. And that brings unique insights, because every now and then, you know, we disagree, might be a cage match, but you know, he heals up quickly because I always win. You come in with me like that. But the story's blowing up. It's happening now because racial equity and reparations movement is the most important story in our country today. And it's collided in real time with COVID and all the protests happening in cities across the country, and now the insurrection and the change of the administration, which means H.R. 40 has new life, and Congressman Sheila Jackson Lee, who's moving that forward from John Conyers, who had it before, has the wind at her back with a new House and Senate majority. So we know that there's a tug of war with the old guard versus the new guard, and we're wondering whether that's going to, how that's going to play out. So we're looking forward to making that film. But you got to imagine, if there were cameras on Rosa Parks on the earliest days of the Montgomery bus boycott, watching Robin Rue Simmons do that in her hometown of Evanston, Illinois, is exactly what that is. It feels like we're watching the birth of the Rosa Parks of reparations. And we interviewed you for it as well. So yeah, so that's what we're up to. And so look forward to that.
Wow, I'm just so very excited. I'm just so very excited for the expertise that you're going to be bringing to this issue and to the influence that this film is going to have. Thank you, Erica, so very much. And
thank
I just
you,
love
Nikichi.
Matt.
I just love you. Mwah! And she loves you too. Rock on.
Attorney Jeffrey Robinson, you currently serve as Deputy Legal Director for the ACLU and Director of his Strong Center for Justice and Equality. I was excited with you leading the ACLU support of H.R. 40 and reparations. I was excited with you being intentional and partnering with groups such as the National African American Reparations Commission. And I am really excited now about your latest project, Who We Are. Tell us about this project and just how it relates to the issue of reparations.
Well, thank you very much. And the Who We Are project is a project that really came out of my examination about America's history of white supremacy and racism that was really sparked when my 13-year-old nephew came to live with my wife and I as our son, because his mother passed away and his grandmother passed away and they were raising him. My wife and I didn't have kids. And when this young man came into our home, I'm looking at this beautiful young Black man, and he's asking me questions like, what do I do if the police roll up on me? What do I do if they come to a party? And I was, Nkechi, I was scared. And I started reading. I don't even know what I was looking for. But I started reading about facts that I had never heard of about our history, the history of Black people in this country. And I hadn't heard of them, even though I went to Marquette University and Harvard Law School and had one of the best educations in America. But that education was based in the majority view of what our country was and the myths about our country. As I found out this information, it had a huge impact on me, and I believe it will have a huge impact on Americans. So I can't say, I wish I could say that I started the Who We Are Project, the documentary film that we're about to release, and the work that we're going to do. I wish I could say that I started that thinking of reparations, but I didn't. I started it thinking of, we just need to tell the truth about our history. And as I then, working with you and Dr. Daniels and other people who have been in the reparations fight, it just became clear. This work is just a justification of H.R. 40 and everything that it stands for. Because the history that I was putting together and seeing play out in front of me was the history that is described in H.R. 40 and that will bring us to a place where America can finally address our legacy of white supremacy and racism. It's about time, and I am thrilled to be in this fight right now.
Who We Are, looking forward to it. Thank you so very much, Attorney Jeffrey Robinson. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's special broadcast, Black History in the Making, Reclaiming Our Past, Redefining Our Future. I'm Nkechi Taifa of WPFW in Washington, D.C.
Till black folks find no fix.
For the end of the nation, the word is reparations. For the healing of the nation, the word is reparations.
As a teenager, I used to sell Black Panther Party newspapers on the streets of Washington, D.C. One day, I sat on the curb and opened the paper to its 10-point program, What We Want, What We Believe. I was mesmerized by point number 3, which was talking about the right to reparations. Well, there's another 10-point reparations program out there that's been developed. We are about to hear from Dr. Vaughn Daniels, president of the Institute of the Black World 21st Century, author of Still on This Journey, and a longtime advocate for justice. He is the convener of NARC. Dr. Daniels, can you please tell us just what NARC stands for and briefly touch on some of the key points of its 10-point reparations program?
Well, thank you for having me. NARC stands for the National African American Reparations Commission. Yes, we have a national commission that's dealing with the questions of reparations. Its mission really is to be a framework and a reference for the national dialogue and debate on reparations. We have a 10-point program. That 10-point program includes the idea of a knowledge program. It includes the ability for repatriation, that is to say, those who want to go back to Africa with reparations, housing, economic development, information infrastructure, and in dealing with sacred sites. You know, the fact that we have lynchings and massacres all over the country that have not been fully recognized and dealt with. And repairing, finally and definitively, the criminal injustice system, including freeing all political prisoners and prisoners of war. So that's what the program looks like, and we are organizing around it all over the country.
Thank you so very much, Dr. Daniels. And I just can't wait till all this comes to fruition. Today, reparations initiatives are popping up all over the place, from initiatives in cities and states, religious institutions and universities, corporations and industries. We will now hear from advocates in 4 jurisdictions, Evanston in Chicago, Illinois, Tulsa, Oklahoma, and Elaine, Arkansas, that have reparations initiatives for the legacies from the enslavement era. very excited to present my next guest straight out of Evanston, Illinois. Alderman Robin Ruth Simmons, congratulations. You will go down in history as the architect of the concept of using tax revenue from your jurisdiction's legal cannabis industry to fund reparations initiatives. Many of us hope that this will be a model for initiatives across the country. Please tell us just what led you to take this historic step.
Absolutely. And first, thank you for having me in Kichi. Very happy to be here. And I'll tell you what led me is what should be leading other cities and this nation towards reparative justice in the name of reparations for Blacks in America. Specifically in our city, we had done equity work, diversity and inclusion work very well for many years. We continue to do it and will continue to do it because it is appropriate good public policy. But in our city, as hard as we were working, we still only sustained the oppression and the racial divide between Black and white Evanston, specifically a household income divide of $46,000, a life expectancy gap of 13 years, education gap, and so on. It was important that we did something as radical as the Jim Crowing and redlining that we experienced in our city to repair damages done, to bring remedy to the conditions in the Black community. And specifically in using the tax revenue from adult use cannabis was because additionally a disparate data point in our city was that 71% of the marijuana arrests were in the Black community, and we are only 16% of Evanston. So therein lies, again, another damage, another injury, an injury that continues on in not having access to employment or housing or student loan resources. In Evanston, we advanced reparations for the Black community because it was time and it was overdue. And I'm proud of our city. I hope other cities will consider the same.
Phenomenal. Thank you so very much, Alderman Robin Rusin. Cam Howard, you serve as the Mayo co-chair of National in COBRA, as well as chair of the Chicago chapter, and have played a leading role as a reparations thought leader. Can you tell us specifically about the advocacy you led in getting the Chicago City Council to establish a reparations commission and just what the dictates of that commission are?
Wow. Thank you, Nkechi, for that question. So, yeah, so early on in the process here in Chicago, and COBRA got involved, I got a call from Dr. Conrad Worrell, who you know is a major reparations leader in the country. He told me that a businessman had persuaded a city alderman and two state legislators to craft reparations legislation in the city and the state and asked me to go to that meeting. So at the very first public meeting, we went and we saw that the bill that they were introducing was really not a reparations bill. It was more of an anti-poverty bill. And COBRA made that statement. They heard our statement and they suggested that Dr. Worrell, myself, the commissioner who had wrote the initial legislation and the alderman who was going to introduce the legislation, that we hold a series of meetings and actually craft what we thought would be an actual reparations bill. And we did that. And it was introduced in the city council, and then it was forwarded to the Health and Human Relations Commission. And once we got it forwarded to that commission, we then began to do a number of citywide forums, what we call symposiums. They were entitled, we did those under the theme, Making the Demand for Reparations in the City of Chicago. And what we wanted to do was build a case on what we thought were the foundational issues in every locality, every city where Black people live. What is the basis from which a reparations claim can be made? And we thought there were three foundational issues. One was genocide. The second was plunder. And the third issue was apartheid. Spoke on those three issues. We got a unanimous decision by the Health and Human Relations Commission to establish a reparations commission.
So, Cam, thank you so very much for that. And we're going to keep our eye on that. And thanks for all your pivotal work. Say it loud.
You're listening. listening to Black History in the Making, Reclaiming Our Past, Redefining Our Future. This show is presented by Pacifica Radio's COVID, Race, and Democracy and the Pacifica COVID Task Force.
Attorney DeMario, you are the mover and shaker behind the recently filed Tulsa, Oklahoma lawsuit stemming from the 1921 race massacre of the Greenwood District, popularly known as Black Wall Street. You've assembled an impressive legal team. Can you describe for us some of the claims that you made in the lawsuit and just what you hope to achieve?
Absolutely. First of all, thank you for having me on your magnificent show. And I have been blessed to put together a magnificent team, as you stated. We have two primary claims. Number one is a public nuisance claim, and it's very, very powerful here in Oklahoma. It was recently used by the state of Oklahoma to win a $573 million verdict against opioid companies. And primarily, this is the claim that the 1921 massacre created a problem. It created a nuisance, and that nuisance has continued to this day. As we speak today, that nuisance is in the form of Black people living less than 11 to 14 years less than white Tulsans. We live in 35% in poverty. We own our homes three times less than white Tulsans. Our schools are in shambles. It's a food desert. Our Black businesses have been decimated, and the list can go on and on and on. And we're able to show specifically with evidence, documentation, how the policies and the actions of the city and other defendants created this nuisance stemming from the massacre. Because the massacre was about taking the land that the valuable land that Black people owned. That has been the entire purpose and plan of the defendants this entire time, to the point now that Greenwood went from 40 blocks to now half a block. I say that again, Greenwood went from 40 blocks to half a block. And so we want to make sure that we get back what was taken.
Thank you, Attorney DeMario Solomon Simmons of Tulsa, Oklahoma. Reverend Dr. Iva Carruthers, I know you as the general secretary, the mover and shaker of the influential Samuel DeWitt Proctor Conference interdenominational organization within the African-American faith tradition focused on justice and equity issues. But you know what? Only recently did I learn of your direct connection with Elaine, Arkansas, and that bloody 1919 massacre of hundreds of Black people. Can you just briefly share with us what happened in Elaine yesterday and what's happening right here now today related to reparations?
Well, thank you so much for having me, my dear sister. And I just love your energy. Despite the fact that we're talking about this topic, which holds so much trauma and pain, et cetera, for our people. But let me just say that the 1919, as you have casted it, was a bloody massacre of our people who were doing no more than exercising their human dignity and self-determination to be economically free, to be spiritually free, and to be able to raise their families in a safe and healthy environment. These were landowners in Elaine, Arkansas, and in the Delta who were and had not only purchased land as formerly enslaved persons, but who had created the kind of successful growing of their crops, bringing them to the marketplace, demanding that their labor be respected at a fair market value, and who, in terms of those whites who were determined to destroy that economic prosperity, said that we will not allow you to either sell your products at fair market value, nor will we allow you to organize your labor. The Black community had gone into a church. The whites came and shot into a church, massacred hundreds, as it turned out, African American people, and not only Elaine, but with a ripple effect throughout the county. In the end, the U.S. federal military were complicit in the ongoing massacres that lasted for days. I was personally impacted in terms of that generationally because my family was in that area, and my great uncle ended up expatriating to Brazil as a result of that. And where we are now is that we're just going back and reclaiming the narrative. We are staying steadfast to the Declaration for Reparations. We understand that our healing is emotional, it is financial, it is spiritual. In every way, we must be healed. And so now we have an initiative which includes not only the Samuel DeWitt Proctor Conference, who had a truth-telling commission in Elaine, Arkansas several years ago, but has embraced the community and being led by the community has now broadened our capacity in collaboration with the National African American Reparations Commission to attract support that is coming from allies, including the Fund for Reparations Now and McCormick Theological Seminary. And the people have declared that they have a vision to create a memorial park, to create a historic preservation initiative, to build a museum, to create it as a destination place. We now have a computer lab that is there that is affording children access to the digital economy. And we are there with the people, in step with them, determined that we will demonstrate reparatory justice is possible.
Thank you so very much for that. I'm really, really looking forward to seeing just what the developments are going to be.
This is COVID, Race, and Democracy. Stay tuned.
Ann Mitchell Iwuor is a cultural communications specialist and founder of the National Black Cultural Information Trust, which specializes in cultural disinformation, voter suppression, reparations, community education, and cross-cultural conflicts. Jessica, you've written extensively about divisiveness and online violence within the reparations movement in this country. Can you talk about what this divisiveness is and what dangers it might pose to the goal of achieving reparations?
Yes, thank you for asking this. So currently, in the past, reparationists have used reparations as a part of the global struggle for Black liberation. But in the last couple of years, there have been some people that have used the reparations movement in order to build false narratives and usher in an era of divisiveness among people of African descent in the diaspora and on the continent. So some of these new, shall I say, reparationists or folks that are entering the reparations movement have entered it through an ahistorical lens, one in which that believes Black Americans are cut off from the rest of the Pan-African world. And so they believe that in order to get reparations, we must embrace a type of Black isolationism instead of Pan-Africanism. They believe that we should cut ourselves off and that we should focus on ourselves as a distinct people, completely separate from the rest of the Pan-African world. And that causes a number of issues because, one, there is no pure Black American identity. And number two, reparations can only be fulfilled within the global context because what happened to us as a people is global. White supremacy is global. We have endured, those of us that are descendants of Africans enslaved in the United States, we have endured slavery here. Our brothers and sisters around the rest of the diaspora also endured slavery. We have our brothers and sisters on the continent that have endured slavery as well as colonialism. So the danger in using nativism and xenophobia and shutting people off from the Pan-African world is that it prevents us from understanding what happened to us on a global scale. And it prevents us from working together and using Black collective activism and Pan-Africanism to our advantage.
Thank you so very much, my sister. Dreesen Heath is a researcher and advocate focused on racial justice and reparations in the U.S. program at Human Rights Watch. Dreesen, you have looked at the issue of reparations both internationally as well as domestically. Can you briefly share with us internationally accepted standards for reparations and how that relates to the quest for reparations in the United States?
Nikichi, thanks so much for having me on. And secondly, I appreciate this question. The right to remedy and reparation is well defined in international human rights law. And under that law, governments have an obligation to provide effective remedies for violations of human rights. And victims should receive adequate, prompt, and effective reparations that are proportional to the gravity of a violation or the cumulative harm suffered. And this right requires that governments ensure access to justice, truthful information, and the violation, which also includes needing to have repair efforts and repair measures. Reparations is defined in five forms: restitution, compensation, rehabilitation, satisfaction, which are truth-telling measures, official apology, guarantees of non-repetition, which are institutional and legal reforms. Just to go back to restitution, that's restoring communities back to a morally acceptable place. And so the U.S. is a party to these international treaties that guarantee these rights and therefore should properly acknowledge and properly account and compensate for gross human rights violations like the institution of slavery and its vestiges, including entrenched structural racism and acts of discrimination that are impacting people today. Slavery was national policy, as we know, and that fueled the U.S. global economy, given the exploitation and dehumanization of Black people. So there's a movement to address this long legacy that has been unaccounted for within a federal bill, H.R. 40, which is gaining unprecedented momentum and will finally provide the first step towards a reparative justice for the Black community in the U.S.
Thank you so very much, Dreesen. We have heard about reparations icons who helped move the modern day reparations movement forward and about redress for the lingering impacts from the enslavement era that impact us today. We have discussed upcoming documentaries and our current day 10-point reparations program. We scrutinized reparations initiatives in four jurisdictions, looked at divisiveness within the movement, and examined international law. The National African American Reparations Commission asserts that no amount of reparations can ever be sufficient restitution for the spiritual, mental, cultural, and physical damages inflicted by centuries of the Ma'afa and its legacies. There is a bill, H.R. 40, that has been waiting in Congress for over 30 years. Pass it or an executive order that puts its study and proposals commission into effect now. Reparations is an issue whose time has come. Reparations now.
Tell me who'll pay reparations on my...
This program was produced by the Taifa Group, Willie Yao Brewer, editor. I'm Nikichi Taifa in Washington, D.C.
This is Black History in the Making, reclaiming our past, redefining our future. The show you just heard was produced in collaboration with the Pacifica COVID Task Force, the production team of COVID Race and Democracy, Pacifica Network stations, and affiliates throughout the country. Our production editors are Paulina Facilia, Nona Alliance, and Akua Holt, along with our media intern, Akono Kamau. Fahima Sack is our line producer. Steve Zelter and Akua Holt are the executive producers. Our theme music by the godfather of Afrobeat, Fela Anikalapo Kuti, Water No Get Enemy. Special thanks to Knitting Factory Records and Lydia Bazone, interim executive director of the Pacifica Network.
Listen to this and other programs online and discover more about COVID, race, and democracy at covidtaskforce.pacifica.org, covidtaskforce.pacifica.org. Thank you for listening.